morning, and good morning, and welcome to the April 21st edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. How's everybody doing out there?
Okay. Today on Mountain Money, we'll begin our hour by speaking with author Brian Goldstone about his book, Working and Homelessness in America, There Is No Place for Us. Then we'll speak with Ann Weldy about the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses Program. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Drs. Danny Whiteman and Wyatt Horsley about the Concierge Medical Program at Uner Mountain Hospital. All this and more on Mountain Money. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. The term homeless in America is typically associated with men and women who are under the influences of drugs or alcohol and or are mentally ill. But there is a substantial homeless population that consists of people who work low-income jobs and struggle to maintain places to live for themselves and their children. Author Brian Goldstone takes a deep and nuanced look into the lives of some of those people in his new book, There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. We are very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Brian, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So, Brian, let's start with, you know, why did this book come into existence? What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So the genesis for the book actually was the fact that my wife, who's a nurse practitioner, she was working at a community health center here in Atlanta where we live, and she began to notice this really startling trend. She was seeing patients again and again and again who were working these low-wage jobs. They were working at Walmart or McDonald's, or they were packing boxes for Amazon, or they were driving for Uber and Lyft. And when they finished their shifts, they were going not to an apartment, but they were, you know, sometimes sleeping in the very car they had just done those shifts for Uber and Lyft in, or, you know, they were going to the overcrowded apartments of others, or they were going to homeless shelters, or increasingly they were going to these, you know, terrible, these squalid extended stay hotel rooms. And when she told me about this, it really just like upended all of my assumptions about homelessness. And it led me to this magazine story that I wrote about a family in Atlanta, this working family who, by the time I met them, had been homeless for about 4 months. And even after I finished that magazine article, I realized I had only scratched the surface of this phenomenon.
And the book is very Atlanta-centric. I mean, it really is interesting. And as I was reading it, I was thinking of it as the bookend to Thomas Wolfe's A Man in Full. In other words, the other side of Atlanta. Yes. But before we get down, and obviously I want to spend some time talking about extended stay hotels and motels and some of the other things you deal with in the book. But can we do a little bit of big picture? Do you have some information on the scope of the issue? What is the relationship between income and housing costs in America and in Atlanta in particular? And how has that relationship changed over the last decade or so?
Sure. So, you know, although the book is set in Atlanta, I think it's really important to emphasize really, you know, upfront that this story that is told in the book is really an American story. This is not just an Atlanta story. The scale of this catastrophe, this housing catastrophe, this homelessness disaster nationwide really is mind-blowing. One statistic that I cite in the book is that since 1985, rents have outpaced income gains in this country nationwide by 325%. And, you know, today there isn't a single state, city, or county in the entire United States where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford just a modest sort of average price two-bedroom apartment. So in that sense, you know, the fact that a lot of our news coverage of the housing crisis, the homelessness crisis, tends to be centered in kind of the predictable cities, LA, San Francisco, New York. That's actually not doing us a service. We should be basing our stories in cities like Atlanta, because Atlanta really is representative of any number of sort of mid-size, you know, quote, up-and-coming cities, Nashville, Charlotte, Phoenix, Salt Lake, you name it, where this chasm between what our workers are earning and what it just costs to keep a place to live is growing and growing even wider, you know, by the day.
Yeah.
You talk in the book a little bit about how, you talk about it in Atlanta in particular, but the general phenomenon of how urban renewal projects have sort of affected the availability of lower cost housing in major urban areas. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, one kind of counterintuitive point that the book tries to make is that we tend to associate homelessness with poverty. We tend to think of homelessness as sort of springing up in the most kind of impoverished parts of the country or the city, the kind of inner city as it used to be called, and the hollowed out urban core. But the sort of new American homelessness that this book documents, where, you know, millions of low-wage workers are, I'm really careful to use the language of not falling into homelessness, but being pushed into homelessness. This is happening not in the poorest areas of the country, but in the wealthiest parts. It's the result, I argue, not of a failing economy, but of booming economies, where, you know, urban space is being revitalized, where city centers are being transformed, where unemployment is at a historic low, corporate profits are surging, and paradoxically and really perversely, the very people whose jobs, whose labor is powering that growth, is making that boom possible through their work, they're not just being pushed out of the neighborhoods they grew up in, they are increasingly being pushed out of housing altogether. And that really is, I think, something striking about this new homelessness in America, that it's being fueled by prosperity, not by poverty.
Yeah. Let's jump into Maurice and Natalia. They're married. They both have full-time jobs. Can you share a bit about how events push them, as you say, push them into homelessness and made it so difficult to escape it?
Sure. You know, Maurice and Natalia, they defy all the stereotypes we might have about people experiencing homelessness in this country. They're a two-parent household. It's not, you know, it's not a single mom. It's a two-parent household. And they grew up in DC. They're a Black family. They grew up in DC. They thought that they were going to raise their kids in DC, just as they were raised there. But by the time they're adults, they're realizing that they're getting priced out of their rapidly gentrifying neighborhood in DC. And so, you know, like many, many Black Americans whose relatives, you know, whose grandparents, great-grandparents actually fled the Jim Crow South in search of economic opportunity in the North as part of what's called the Great Migration, they actually become part of what's called the New Great Migration of those same, you know, families moving back to the South, back to, you know, cities where some economic opportunity might be found. And so they come to Atlanta thinking that they're going to be coming to the Black Mecca, as it's called, you know, that they are going to be able to achieve their middle class aspirations here. They both have relatively good jobs. Natalia's working at the call center for State Farm, and Maurice is working for Enterprise Rental Car. And, you know, they are stably housed for several years in Atlanta, in an apartment with their kids. And, you know, the first domino that kind of falls that ends up pushing them into homelessness is the fact that their rental home, what they thought of as their home, was really just an investment vehicle for the person who owned this home. She was a very nice person, and she very nicely informed them that their lease was going to be prematurely terminated and not renewed. And this sort of thrust them into what one caseworker in this book calls the housing hunger games. It thrust them into this, quote, hot housing market where the ground had kind of shifted under their feet and rents had skyrocketed far beyond what they could afford. And yeah, that was the kind of the first domino that fell. And as the book proceeds, they and their children end up homeless. They end up living in a motel room at Extended Stay America, this squalid studio-sized hotel room, where in the span of 8 months, they spend $17,000, which is more than double what they had been paying for a two-bedroom apartment down the road. And, you know, we begin to see how this expensive prison, as they call their extended stay hotel room, how this expensive prison is so profitable for those who own it. It's actually, Extended Stay America was purchased by Blackstone and Starwood Capital, these private equity giants, during the pandemic because they saw how extremely lucrative all this insecurity has become.
Taking advantage of the disadvantage. Yep.
Preying on their desperation, exactly.
Yeah. I want to get to some of the other characters in the book, but let's just do a little bit more about, you know, how those dominoes fall. First, Maurice and Natalia, where do they go first?
Well, so they first end up using a co-signing company, it, you know, what we learn in the course of following these five families is that at every step in their journeys, there are entire business models, often new business models, designed to really capitalize on their predicament, to squeeze every bit of profit as can be squeezed from their situation. And in their case, you know, when it was time to try to find another apartment after their landlord decided not to renew their lease, their credit was low. Natalia, because of student loan debt largely, you know, their credit scores were pretty low. And so they had to use what's called a co-signing company, pay this exorbitant fee to basically have this company co-sign in order to have a landlord rent to them again. And they end up in an apartment paying way, way more than they had been paying for their previous place. But this, they have the misfortune, as so many Americans now do, of ending up in a property, a multifamily apartment complex owned by a group called Covenant Capital, based in Nashville, another private equity firm. And when they are just a couple of days late on their rent, they fall victim to this automated eviction system where there's no human to interact with. You can't call a number in the leasing office and, you know, as you would with kind of a mom and pop landlord, say, hey, you know, I get my paycheck Friday, I promise I'll pay by then. Instead, there is this automated eviction that is filed against them. And that ends up, you know, being fateful. They're unable to recover. They try to cut costs wherever they can. They're late on their car note and their car almost gets repossessed. Their lights are getting turned off. They begin going to, you know, they begin getting food stamps, and they're doing everything they possibly can to just pay their rent. And when that fails, they get pushed out of their apartment and into their room at Extended Stay America.
And again, we do want to get to that with some more detail. But before we do that, and one of the things that should be obvious is this book covers five families. We can't really get into the stories of all of them, but all of them are really extraordinarily interesting and pretty depressing. You point out another sort of element I wanted to get to was you point out that public assistance programs, you know, we have this vision of the safety net. You talk about how public assistance programs are both limited and hard to access. Can you explain a bit about, let's use Britt as the example. She gets a housing voucher. Why didn't it lead to a stable housing situation for her?
Well, you know, yeah, in Britt's case, Britt, through her own story, is kind of, you could tell the history of housing policy in America just through this one individual journey. You know, Britt grew up in public housing back when public housing still existed. Atlanta was actually the first city in the country to build public housing in the 30s. And in the 90s and 2000s, when Britt is growing up, it becomes the first city in the country to begin demolishing all its public housing in favor of kind of turning the housing need, you know, providing for the housing needs of low income and poor Americans to the private market. And the way that happened is the government basically said, okay, we're going to try to, instead of build housing ourselves as the government and run it, maintain it, we're going to give people these vouchers to go to a landlord and have a good chunk of their rent subsidized by the government instead. Now, one problem is that only one out of four families and individuals, one in four households who qualify, who check all of the boxes to even qualify for this crucial form of assistance, are actually able to receive it. So 75% of renter households in this country who, again, check all the boxes, they work, they don't have criminal backgrounds. We've made it extremely difficult to even qualify for this assistance, but 75% of families who qualify don't even get it. And instead, we've created what's literally called a lottery to determine who gets this vital form of aid. And Britt, miraculously, she wins the lottery. When the book opens, she's been on the voucher waiting list for 2 years after winning this lottery. And finally, when the book opens, her name is selected to get off the waiting list, to actually receive a voucher. And what is just utterly devastating to witness in the book is that Britt, after getting this voucher, she goes around trying to find a landlord to rent to her, and she gets an extension because she can't find anyone to rent to her. And then she gets another extension. And then finally, this voucher expires and it's taken away from her because she's unable to use it. She's unable to find her landlord. And that same year, when her voucher expired, about 1,600 vouchers in Atlanta were issued to families, and almost 1,100 expired before they could be used. And that's because in these hot rental markets like Atlanta's, and again, Atlanta is just representative of any number of cities across the country, in this hot rental market where you have several people competing for just one unit, landlords don't have a financial incentive to take these vouchers because they can't jack up rents whenever they want. They can keep these rental properties in substandard conditions. So instead, they're going to rent to someone who doesn't have a voucher, and Britt lost her voucher as a result.
And then what happened there?
And then Britt too, you know, actually, what happens after she loses her voucher, she's homeless for a time with her kids. And then she ends up getting into one of the few what are called second chance apartment complexes. And these are places where people who might have low credit scores or evictions on their records or who just can't afford much because they're making super low wages in their jobs. She ends up in one of these complexes, and it's called Gladstone Apartments. It's nothing to write home about. There's no dishwasher. It's a very bare bones kind of place. It's not the safest place in the world, but it's a home. And during the pandemic, she thinks that she is stably housed in this place that she can actually afford. It's not quite as affordable as it was with the rent if she had gotten the voucher. But, you know, this complex is very close to the Atlanta Beltline. It's this mixed use trail that runs around the perimeter of the city, and everything the Beltline touches, it's like someone has waved a magic wand. Or from another perspective, Britt's perspective, it's like an evil wizard has cast a curse. And you know, if you own property near the Beltline, you're happy because your property values are soaring. But if you're a low-income renter living in one of these complexes, the complex during the pandemic was sold to a luxury developer, and all of the families living at this complex were evicted en masse. And the complex was torn down, and all of the families were sort of left to fend for themselves, and Britt and her children become homeless. In the title of the book, There Is No Place For Us, it actually comes from Britt as she returns to this neighborhood months later, and she sees how beautiful it now is, and she sees the new breweries and the all the eateries and yoga studios, and she's like, wow, this place is really nice, but me and my kids, there's no place for us here. And, you know, that's as much a material statement as it is an existential one for her.
One theme that is repeated in the book is that government programs define homelessness in some fairly narrow ways. How does that impact the ability of the homeless to access what programs there are as a practical matter?
Yeah, so and a really startling thing that I point to in the book is that the actual number of people experiencing homelessness in this country is roughly, conservatively, 6 times greater than the official figure. So the last 2 years, we had the highest levels of homelessness on record. Since homelessness began to be counted by the federal government in what's called the point in time count, the last 2 years have seen record-breaking numbers. But, you know, as bad as those official figures are, the reality is much, much worse, roughly 6 times worse. And so, you know, what I try to argue is that the reason why homelessness has been narrowed in that way, why we only count every year, we only count people who are on the street, visible, or living in shelters. Everyone else, all of the families I write about in this book, people like Britt, people like Maurice and Natalia, they literally don't count. They literally have been written out of the story we as a country tell ourselves about homelessness. And the consequences of that aren't just that the root causes of this catastrophe are obscured, because if we're only looking at those on the street, we might be able to tell ourselves this comforting story about how homelessness is caused by individual choices or mental illness or addiction, because so many of the people we see on the street seem to be, you know, suffering from substance use or mental illness. What we don't realize is that that's not why they became homeless. I want to be absolutely clear that the reason all of the close to 4 million people in this country currently experiencing homelessness Why people become unhoused in America is simple. It's because they don't have access to housing they can afford. And mental illness, substance use, that can come as a consequence, as a byproduct of that insecurity. But that is not what causes people to become homeless. But when we narrow the field, when we narrow the definition, we not only kind of obscure those root causes, but we also lock all of those people who fall outside that definition, we lock them out of crucial assistance. And so when these families in the book, when they go to try to get help, they are told by caseworkers, I'm so sorry, you just don't fit the definition of homeless because you're in your car, or you're in one of these hotels, or you're living in overcrowded apartments with others. You just don't fit the definition. And in that sense, you know, the only thing worse than being homeless in this country is not even being able to receive the designation homeless in this country, which really just throws you into this kind of purgatory where there's no way out of it.
Now, do they have to say that they're not living in a car, that they're not living with in a small apartment with a bunch of other people or an extended stay in order to get any kind of help?
Yeah, I mean, the system sort of incentivizes people to begin to lie. Yeah. You know, once people learn how it works, once you go to these interviews, you wake up before dawn and you get in line, as Celeste, one of the characters in the book, does. You get in line before dawn and there's a line snaking around the building, and 9-10 hours later you finally get seen for an interview and you've come prepared to tell your story and to talk about the circumstances you're living with, and instead, after a 2-minute interview, you're told, sorry, you don't fit the definition. Yeah, you learn to tweak things so that you do fit that definition. And people waiting in that line begin to say, hey, if you want help, this is what you've got to say. And it's just very sad that we force people into a position where they have to lie in order to just get this basic help. But, you know, the reality is that even, you know, as with that voucher, you know, those lucky enough to even qualify for this assistance, who even fit the definition of homeless, There's just too few resources even to help them. So we're really looking at a system that is stretched mind-blowingly thin. And, you know, what we're seeing now in this country with the current administration is this already threadbare support system, this already shredded safety net, just being decimated even more.
Yeah. I just mentioned the extended stay. So the Efficiency Lodge appears in the book many times. Can you explain the role that extended stay facilities play for the working poor?
Yeah, for me, as a resident of Atlanta, I was just astonished to find that these hotels and motels that I had been driving by every single day are not hotels and motels as we tend to think of them. These extended stay hotels are not, you know, we're not talking about a Residence Inn or a Homewood Studios where business travelers or traveling medical workers might stay, or where you might stay if you have a relative in the hospital for a period of time. These are effectively for-profit homeless shelters. These places are at the bottom end of the spectrum. The conditions are essentially slum conditions with, you know, broken plumbing, black mold, rodents, cockroaches, you name it. Just abysmal conditions where, you know, as with Maurice and Natalia, people are spending sometimes double what they would have been spending in an apartment down the road. But because of their credit score, this 3-digit number that has come to determine whether millions of people in this country can get into the formal housing market, because their credit score is too low, they are trapped in these places, in these hotels. And, you know, here in DeKalb County where I live, and I'm sure something is similar, I'm sure it's similar in Park City and other cities throughout Utah, there isn't a single family homeless shelter here. So in the absence of family homeless shelters, where do families go? They go to these hotels. And, you know, by definition, these places are filled with working people, with people with incomes, because you have to have an income to stay there. Rent is due not every month, but every week. And if you're even a day late, you're locked out. And there are people who have been living at these hotels not for months, but for years. School buses pull up there every morning to pick up the kids who are staying there. And just in Atlanta alone, there are tens of thousands of these families in these hotels and motels. It's an entire world of homelessness that we don't see, that we don't realize even exists. And this world of homelessness has, again, become extremely profitable. As I mentioned, Wall Street investors are taking note of how lucrative these places are. And so they're not only cornering the market on rental housing that people currently have, they're not only buying up single family homes and Airbnbs and so forth, they're increasingly buying up the very places where families are forced into once they lose their housing. And that's what's really startling about this entire phenomenon, just how much money is being made from these people's desperation.
Yeah, yeah. So so we identified a lot of the problems. So in your view, where do we go from here?
I think, there's all sorts of immediate policy solutions that can be implemented to ease these people's suffering. Everything from keeping people in the homes they already have through rent stabilization, rent cap. There's no reason why only homeowners who have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage should be assured that their housing costs aren't going to be going up one year to the next. But for renters, they have none of that security. And so I think, there are policies that can limit what I think of as kind of the price gouging, where there's this limited supply and those who are lucky enough to own the supply are just charging whatever they want for it, even way past the rate of inflation. So, we need to keep people in the homes they already have through tenant protections, through habitability standards, through rent stabilization. But we also need to get people, into housing who don't already have it. And for that, we need to just build way more affordable housing, low income housing for America's workers. And frankly, for those who aren't working, just everyone in this country should have a place to live. And that really brings me to, one of the most important points, I think, is that before we can even talk about these concrete policy solutions, we as a country have to have a paradigm shift around housing. We think of housing as a commodity, as this vehicle for accumulating wealth, as an investment vehicle. But, we don't think of education that way. We don't think of clean water that way. And housing is an essential human good. It's just something that everyone needs. And what we have to do is we have to start thinking of housing as something that everyone should have access to in this wealthiest nation on earth. And, we have to start building policies from there, because this will truly take a massive degree of political will and public investment to solve this catastrophe.
The book is Homeless in America. There is no place for us working and homeless in America. We've been speaking with author Brian Goldstone. It's a fascinating book. There are some bright spots, including the story about a woman named Pink, who does incredible work with the homeless. Wish we had more time to talk about her. Brian, thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
From time to time, financial news and information networks will have experts on air to speak about what's happening and possibly predictions about what may happen in the financial world. Representatives from Goldman Sachs are often sought out to be these experts. But that's not the only thing Goldman Sachs is known for. The big picture is that Goldman Sachs supports small businesses across the country with their 10,000 Small Businesses program. Joining us to tell us more is Ann Weldy, National Director of Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So let's see. Last week was the event in Salt Lake City and Governor Cox was in on the festivities. What was the event and what role did the governor have at the event?
Sure. We were celebrating a number of incredible achievements on behalf of both Goldman Sachs and the 10,000 Small Businesses program earlier this month. We were not only recognizing 25 years of Goldman Sachs operating in Salt Lake, but we were also marking the graduation of our newest class of small business owners who had completed the 10,000 Small Businesses program. And what that meant was that we had also surpassed the milestone of now having worked with over 1,000 small business owners from the Salt Lake area across our 12-year commitment in the city for the 10,000 Small Businesses program. And what we were really excited to be joined by Governor Cox in announcing is that we are also expanding the 10,000 Small Businesses program statewide across Utah. So what does that mean? It means that small business owners across Utah can now access the 10,000 Small Businesses program, which is a training program for small business owners that helps equip them with the skills and tools to take their business to the next level.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit more about that? If I'm a small business and I'm listening to this and I'm going, how can I do this? What would it involve and how would I sign up?
So what it involves for a small business owner is applying to and getting accepted into a 12-week-long comprehensive business training program that covers all the fundamentals that a business owner needs to know in order to run and grow and scale their business, whether that's a deep dive on their business financials, operations and processes, leadership and hiring. And business owners really take a 360-degree view of their business mm-hmm. to really understand what they need to know to take it to the next level. And in doing so, they're also taking 10,000 small businesses with a class of 30 other business owners. So they're learning from one another each day that they're in the classroom. And I think the thing that's most important is that this is a practical program designed for small business owners to put into their business right away. So it means that a business owner is learning about their operations and processes in the classroom, and they're implementing it with their team the next day. So it's really designed to help business owners apply it right away.
So they're not spending 2 years getting their MBA, or if they're working full time, spending 4 or 5 years.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you mentioned that, I think you mentioned that there were 1,000 small businesses in Utah. Give us a sense of the scope of the program nationally. What does that 10,000 number mean, and how many businesses have participated in it?
So we have now worked with over 16,600 business owners across 50 states. We have surpassed our target of reaching 10,000. We are well on our way to 20,000. This is also a community that represents $27.7 billion in aggregate revenue. And right here in Salt Lake, that also means it's a community of over 1,000 business owners that represent over $2 billion in revenue and employ over 24,000 people. So it is an incredible community of growth-oriented and growing small business owners of pretty much every background you could possibly imagine, from the small IT company to the pet accessories business to the small manufacturer. There's pretty much every possible business profile in the 10,000 small businesses community that you can think of.
Now, what if someone owns a landscaping company? Is a small businesses program for them?
Absolutely. So really what we are looking for in terms of applicants to the 10,000 small businesses program are those that have 2 or more employees, have been in operation for 2 or more years, and have more than $75,000 in gross revenue. And so we are truly talking about small business. Mm-hmm. And really the goal there being equipping a small business owner with the skills and the training that they need to know to take their business to the next level.
And then this program has been around for a while. Are there any sort of notable success stories that you can share with us of someone who came into this program and is now a business we might recognize?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to. So one of the business owners that I had the good fortune of reconnecting with just earlier this month when we were celebrating our event with Governor Cox in Salt Lake is Natalie Caddis. So Natalie is an incredible entrepreneur from the Salt Lake area. She's the CEO of Caddis Enterprises, and she's a graduate of our very first cohort in Salt Lake. She took over the business from her in-laws in 2008, and she has completely turned it around. Her growth plan when taking 10,000 small businesses is that she wanted to expand internationally. She is now in 15 countries around the world. When she started the 10,000 small businesses program, her manufacturing facility was 15,000 square feet. She is now in a manufacturing facility that is almost 100,000 square feet. So she has really grown her business in incredible ways, and she has implemented many of the facets of the 10,000 Small Businesses program in that growth journey.
And do you run similar events in other states around the country, given the scope of the program?
We absolutely do. So in 2023, we announced a $100 million investment in rural communities, where we targeted reaching 20 states over 5 years. And with our announcement earlier this month, Utah is now our 11th state as part of that investment in rural communities. And so we have been celebrating along the way as we have been expanding the footprint of 10,000 small businesses into these 20 predominantly rural states. And we see real opportunity to do the same in Utah. And that's why we're really excited that we are now accepting applications from across the state of Utah for 10,000 small businesses for any small business owner that wants to apply.
So let's say we have a business owner in southern Utah, St. George, for instance, and do they have to spend 12 weeks in Salt Lake City, or is it a Zoom kind of thing? How does that work, please?
Absolutely. So they do not, and that's by design. We know that is a long drive to ask a business owner who has a lot on their plate. So what a business owner can expect is that there will be 3 or 4 days in person in Salt Lake at the beginning of the program. followed by 10 weeks of online learning. So that's mostly Zoom or small group conversations or meetings with a business advisor that every small business owner is paired with during the program. And then we ask them to come back to Salt Lake for 3 or 4 days at the end of the program. So it's just 2 trips, a lot more manageable for a busy business owner, and really designed to leverage technology for as much efficiency as possible, but also understanding that so much of the in-person connection is really valuable for CEOs and busy entrepreneurs who are seeking a network.
And you mentioned that you responded to Kevin's question about a landscaping company. Share a little bit about the range of companies, the types of companies that that have gone through the program here.
I think that there is probably just about every type of small business possibly imagine. I'll rattle off a couple of favorites of mine. We have a pest control business. We have a gluten-free bakery. We have a construction company that's helping to rehabilitate row houses in Baltimore. So really, there is a wide, wide range. The minimum requirements are that a business owner has 2 or more employees, including the business owner themselves, and 2 or more years in operation. But we have seen businesses right at that level and much bigger. And really what we're looking for across the board are businesses that have a growth mindset, are really excited about learning what they need to know to take their business to the next level and really kind of taking those lessons from the program so that they can invest back in their communities.
Okay. So listeners, grab a pen and paper. And what is a website that they can sign up for this?
Please apply at 10ksbapply.com, and applications are due July 16th. And that's again 10ksbapply.com.
So it's 12 weeks, and if you're traveling, you travel up twice. Is it Monday through Friday, 8 hours a day? Can they run their business while they're in this 12-week program?
We absolutely want business owners to while they're in this program. We don't want anyone turning up the lights or closing the doors. So it is all meant to be complementary to a busy entrepreneur running their business day in and day out. The Zoom meetings on those online weeks are a couple hours a day, a couple days a week. The in-person sessions in Salt Lake are all day and they are intensive, but we view that as an exercise in delegation.
I don't know if you're going to know the answer to this, but as we were getting ready to record the interview, Kevin and I were talking. Can you tell us a little bit about the scope of Goldman Sachs' operations here in Utah outside of the 10K? That may not be in your wheelhouse.
What I do know is that we have been proud to be in the Salt Lake community for 25 years, and we are just marking that milestone in our office this year.
Excellent. And I imagine Goldman Sachs is international, kind of like Hattis Enterprises is. Well, that's a great success story. I want to look up that company. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
What I would say is we are accepting all applications from small business owners. We are eager to see a robust pool of applicants from across the entire state of Utah. So we are really calling all rural Utah business owners. Please apply by July 16th. We'd love to see you in the classroom with us.
Excellent. And what does this cost them?
It costs nothing. It is free to the business owners, and we cover all travel costs and all accommodations as well.
No reason not to jump on it. Once again, the website, please.
10ksbapply.com.
We just spoke with Ann Weldy of Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses Program, and thank you very much. We will be right back.
We're joined in the studio this morning by Drs. Danny Whiteman and Wyatt Horsley of the Concierge Medicine Clinic at the Park City Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Horsley. Can you tell me, what is the Concierge Medicine Program at Park City Hospital?
Good morning. The Concierge Medicine Program at Park City Hospital is a primary care clinic, and it's a place where people can receive full spectrum care, not your typical primary care clinic in the sense that we have greatly reduced numbers in ways that you can get higher level of access to your care and not only receive things like annual physicals, but chronic disease management and acute care too.
And how long has the program been in existence?
The program started in November, I believe, of 2020. So it has grown over that time and expanded its services. And we're really excited about what we can bring to our members.
November 2020, was it because of COVID? that it was necessary? People didn't want to walk into offices and sit in the waiting room with masks?
It wasn't necessarily because of COVID, but interestingly enough, and this wasn't just with our clinic, but the interest in what's called direct primary care or concierge medicine really accelerated during that time because of what you just said, the need to get in and have better access. There was obviously heightened concern about medical issues. So it was an interesting time for the program to launch, and it really, I think it really helped move things along, and interest peaked really from the beginning.
And Dr. Raymond, I know you're relatively recently joined the program. Can you help our listeners understand, if you were to summarize the key benefits to the patient, why is this something that is advantageous to a patient?
Great question. Mainly access. Getting basically 24-hour access to your doctor is a big selling point in this program. We have very low, comparatively low, patient numbers. The average internal medicine, family medicine practice is going to run about 3,000, 4,000 patients per doctor. We cap around 400. So that really gives us time to be with our patients.
And in the current insurance model where you have a CPT code of the 6-minute visit, I take it that is not something that you find at your clinic.
Thankfully, I don't have to deal with CPT codes. I don't have to deal with insurance. It's one of the great benefits. I feel like, I say this all the time, but I feel like this is how medicine should be practiced.
So if my doctor doesn't have time to get back to me, it's not because he's on vacation, because he has another 2,999 patients.
Often, yes.
And that's why I should be in concierge.
That's a great reason to come over to our practice.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Dr. Wyman, well, let's start with you, Dr. Horsley. Share a little bit about your background and how you came to join the practice.
So I'm originally from Salt Lake. I did my undergrad at the University of Utah, and you know, fast forwarding to the adult professional years, I did my medical school at Rusk University and eventually residency at Indiana University. Stayed on there just as a traditional family practitioner, and that was a great sort of, you know, cutting of the teeth to get into just high volume primary care. Became disillusioned is too strong of a word, but just frustrated as my patients were, that the amount of care, the attention to things, it was just lacking. The volume was so high, as we've already sort of touched on, that I really longed for a different way to provide care to patients, and made a decision to move back to Utah. And this, as life often happens, just sort of fortuitously came up, and I jumped on it, and it's been a great way to practice medicine.
I mean, you can't speak for all other doctors, but it almost seems as though doctors don't like the 2,000 to 3,000, 4,000 patients, because you care about your patients as much as your patients care about having physician care.
I think that's well said. I mean, I completely understandably, patients on the receiving end are, you know, they send a message off, they call to get an appointment, and they're frustrated at the lack of efficiency and the lack of maybe detail sometimes and time given. I think that's something that patients maybe don't know, is that on the doctor end, it is really frustrating for me to walk into a door, and think, I have 15 minutes and I have 45 minutes of things to say to this person that could really help them in their care. And just to know that they were getting, you know, a much more sort of canned, depersonalized answer to problems that really deserved more attention than that. So,
yeah.
And Dr. Raymond, can you similarly share a little bit about your story?
Yeah, absolutely. So born and raised in Salt Lake, similarly did my undergrad at the University of Utah. Admissions to medical school brought me to the Caribbean, American University of the Caribbean specifically, in St. Martin. Did 2 years of schooling there. Second half of the schooling is done in Long Island, New York. So I had my experience over there coming from my Utah background. Then residency, internal medicine residency out in Portland, Oregon.
So you went from St. Martin to Long Island, from one island to a completely different island, but you left St. Martin. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and then what has your career been since your residency?
Yeah, my wife is from North Dakota. I'm from Utah. I hope she doesn't listen to this, but we picked the better of the two states to move back to. So for the last 8-9 years, I've actually been working as a hospitalist in patient medicine up in Ogden, Ogden, Utah. And this opportunity opened up for me. Hospital medicine is notorious for burnout, very high patient volume, certainly a lot of acute care, very significant care. So this opportunity opened up and I just had to jump on it.
So we've talked at a high level about, you know, what this kind of access means. Dr. Hursley, if someone comes in to see you this afternoon, first of all, what are the chances that they could call you this morning and get in to see you this afternoon? And then how long could you spend with them depending on what their needs are?
So we design, you know, the program and model the patient panels specifically with the idea of access and good access in mind. So to answer your question, we would not be upholding our contract agreement with our patients if we did not provide same day or next day access. So that is a lock. You can virtually always, know that that's going to be something that happens. So if you called me today, I would say let's either jump on the phone or come in this afternoon. Some of the benefits of the way that the program's set up is I don't have the same, a traditional physician, in order to be compensated for the visit, has to have it conducted in a specific way in their office or via video. I don't fall under those same constraints because I'm not going to turn around and bill the visit to insurance. So if it's something that can be managed on the phone or via text, appropriately, of course, without cutting corners, then I do that just for, the benefit of patients' time and let's be efficient about it. So just because we have the time to spend with people doesn't mean that if it needs to be a 5-minute visit, that it's a 5-minute visit. But if it needs to be, a 45-minute visit and you think of other things on the way there that you want to talk about, then we spend time doing that as well.
That's the hook right there. To get concierge medicine, holy cow!
And so, Dr. Whiteman, do you guys sort of partner with each other to the extent that if one of you is not available, can the other one step in?
Certainly, yeah. We love to cover for each other. When you establish with one of us as your primary care physician, we really like to keep, I like to keep my patient load, and he likes to keep his patient load. We know the patients, we know their history, and it really makes the visit more efficient for the patient and for us. But if Dr. Horsley's going on vacation, if I'm going on vacation, then certainly we'll step in.
I want to get to specialist access, but I also want to ask about off-hours access. Do you guys, is there a way that someone can reach out to you during the off-hours under this practice?
Certainly. During office hours, we share a phone with our two nurses, our two clinical nurses who are there helping us out, try to help triage some information. If it's a quick yes or no question, they can often help out with that while we're seeing some other patients. Then after hours, the phone is forwarded to our cell phone. I've got that right here in my pocket. So text, call, whatever it may be. You think of a question later in the evening and you want some answers or something significant, you really need to get a hold of your doctor to figure out, is this something that can wait for a visit tomorrow to come into the office? Or is this something I need to head to urgent care or emergency room tonight?
So your phone could blow up at 2:00 in the morning.
Yeah, it blew up at 4 a.m. last night.
Wow. So again, another question is navigate. One of the other things that I think primary care physicians are obviously critical in is assisting patients in navigating specialty networks. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys provide in that respect? And are you only dealing with specialists within Intermountain?
That's a great question. First of all, no, we are not only dealing with specialists in Intermountain healthcare system. We do have good access to them, and there are some amazing physicians that we work with, especially at the Park City Hospital. But we are by no means obligated to send our patients to those specialists. If you need to get to a cardiologist at the University of Utah, if you need to get to a specialist at the Mountain Star system, whatever it may be, whatever's best for the patient, that's who we're going to get the patient to.
Now, do your patients also have insurance? So is there any insurance billing and then the concierge step up?
From our perspective, we don't deal with insurance from our primary care clinic standpoint. Now, that being said, pretty difficult to not have insurance in America, in our healthcare field. So while we do not deal with insurance for the purposes of what we deal with in our office, if there's any laboratory work, imaging, sending to specialists, that will go through insurance regularly.
What does the intake process look like to become part of this practice?
First of all, getting a hold of us, you're welcome to reach out by email, by phone call, through our website, and that will queue into one of our administrators or one of our nurses or one of us to set up some time to come in and visit with us. Initially, we like to set up some time, 30 minutes or so, to bring you in so you can tour the clinic, meet with us as physicians, meet with our nursing staff, see if we'd be a good fit for your primary care needs. Ask questions, whatever it may be. You know, it's not a sales pitch by any stretch. So you come in, meet with us, and see if we'd be a good fit. And at that point, we can get you some information about signing up for the program.
And the bottom line is the bottom line. What are the costs associated with the program?
That was a great question. So it's $5,000 for an individual. We do offer some family plans. If there's two paying members, then children between the age of 13 and 26, dependent children, I should specify, between the ages of 13 and 26 are included with two paying members.
So if someone has an out-of-pocket max of $5,000, you know, they're just an individual, does the $5,000 to you cover my out-of-pocket max on my insurance or not?
We don't bill insurance, right. So it wouldn't be included in that.
Okay.
You're welcome to use health savings accounts, flex spending accounts for the membership fee, but we'll never be billing insurance or anything like that for our purposes.
Okay. We've been talking to Drs. Danny Whiteman and Wyatt Horsley of the Concierge Medicine Clinic at the Park City Hospital.
But before we go, can we get that phone number and get the email address? And I know the web address has a bunch of numbers and such in it, so they can just Google Intermountain Healthcare Concierge and they'll find the website.
They will find the website. That's probably the easiest way to get more information, profiles, information about the clinic and whatnot. Feel free to call 435-658-6750 to contact us directly, and we'd be happy to chat more.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, doctors, and we'll be right back.